is Jonathan Lane from Fan Film Factor, and today I'm here with Mr. Larry Fleming, who has just created a Star Trek fan film called To Have Boldly Gone. Larry, welcome.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here.
Now, I hope you folks have actually watched the two-parter at this point, because we're going to be talking about it, and so there might be some spoilers. But first, Larry, let's talk a little bit about you. Unlike a lot of fan film folks who are complete and total amateurs, as the guidelines say that they have to be, you're actually a semi-professional in the entertainment industry, are you not?
Yes, I am. I have had to hold back my career, if you will. I'm retired, but I've had to hold back on my acting so that I can still do fan films. The new guidelines don't let us be professional, and I can understand that. It's competition. But I've produced quite a number of films on my own besides Star Trek, and I'm on, I don't know, six or seven different crews that do fan films. I love Star Trek, so anytime anybody says they're going to do a film, I said, count me in.
That's true. Yeah, it's almost shorter to list the number of fan films that you're not involved with, Larry. But let me ask you, which fan films are you currently a part of?
Well, the current ones right now, I'm doing anything that Neutral Zone Studios is producing. We've got another short that's coming out here shortly. We've already filmed it. We're probably not going to film a whole lot more down there because it is god-awful hot down there. So take the summer off. But I also work with Randy in Birmingham as part of Timken and Kapok as a Klingon. I work with William in South Georgia when he's doing something down there. I'm part of Dreadnought Dominion. I'd like to be part of Republic again, but that kind of fell apart when Ray got sidetracked with the studio, so I'm hoping to get that back resurrected again. I've worked with quite a number of them. You can just look on my IMDb page. One of the local requirements to get your film listed on our fan production at Treklana is you have to have an IMDb page, and that just, you know, shows you put a little bit of effort into it to make it, you know, semi-legit. Everybody's trying to stay in the guidelines, and we're trying to do that. It's it would be nice if they give us one more 15-minute segment, but we're happy enough to just make sure you got to keep to the storyline and take out all the fluff, because you got to get it right down there to 30 minutes, including credit.
Yeah, and the no professionals thing, that's a sort of it's kind of ambiguous, because the question is, are you using somebody who has never been a professional or is simply not being paid for their work on the fan film? And that's never really been made clear. My feeling was always that there's a feeling that everybody who works in the fan film needs to be an amateur in terms of they are not being paid, they're not doing it as a profession. So in the case of, you know, let's say the Bunny Incident, for example, when Kevin Croxton wrote and produced that, he is an industry professional. It's impossible for him to work on a fan film and not have any professionals on there, because he is the person writing and directing it. And in the case with you as well, you know, you've actually done work in the entertainment industry. You've worked on The Walking Dead and a whole bunch of other films as an extra and as a background player, right?
Yes, as well as acting roles. So, yep. I mean, I've stayed out of SAG deliberately because there's also a limitation with SAG that if you're in the Screen Actors Guild, you can't do independent films unless the independent film is registered and promoted as a SAG film. You can do a low-budget independent, and that's fine, but that's extra paperwork and some extra cost. So most of my independent films that I've worked with, we've stayed out of that, and I had to stay out of the union for that.
Yeah, and of course, the other thing about SAG is you can't not pay people, right? You have to pay them at least a certain amount per day, even if it's a minimum?
Well, I mean, you can work pro bono if you want. Early on when they first started this, it was basically all or nothing, but they've got many levels now. They've got multiple tiers, and you can come in at the super, super, ultra low budget. You know, I don't know what the actual name is now anymore, but you can come in and basically you can work for free. Obviously, you're going to get credits and things like that, and you've got to do all the paperwork. And it's just, it hasn't been worth it. From my point of view, anyway, doing independent films. If I was going to move to the next level up, I'd definitely have no problem joining SAG. That's not an issue of union. It's an issue of still wanting to do what I'm doing. And fan films are really a part of it.
Let me ask you, before we start talking about this particular fan film, why are fan films so important to you? I mean, I know why they're important to me. I'm just sort of curious with other folks who, you know, are quote unquote living the dream and are so dedicated to this, you know, niche of a niche, as we like to call it. You know, why are you here? Why are you doing this stuff?
I've been a fan from the beginning. I watched the original series live when it aired. I wanted to be part of a starship back then. You know, as you're younger, you dream of things like that. And I finally got my wish by being, even on my latest production, captain. We couldn't do that unless we did it as a fan film. But I also like the theme of Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry wanted everybody to see that the future was positive, that we get past our petty differences and we learn to get along. And a lot of the shows dealt with that, some underlying issues where there was a war going on and nobody died unless the computer said so, and then they'd walk into a machine and be disintegrated. That's a petty way of looking at war, but kind of looked at what we were doing back then. We had Vietnam going on. And so it dealt with all the issues, and that's what I like about it. And we can relive some of those issues by redoing the fan films. The other reason that I like doing them is that for a long time there's been a gap between professional Star Trek. Until Discovery recently, we really didn't have anything. The movies, you know, come out once every 2 or 3 years, but basically we didn't have a TV series. And so by doing the fan films, we can keep it alive and just constantly look at new stories. They're fun to watch. I watch them all.
Yeah, I watch them all too. I have my prime directive. Rule number one, there's no such thing as a bad Star Trek fan film. And rule number two, if you see a bad Star Trek fan film, refer to rule number one.
There you go. I mean, and we are amateurs to a degree. My main work has been behind the camera. And so when I step on the camera, you're seeing I've got acting experience, but I'm not Robert Redford or Robert Downey. I'm not any of these big guys. I'm peon. I mean, if you look at my IMDb status, I think I'm at 120,000 or something like that. And they don't know what to do with me because I'm a producer, director, writer, and actor. And so my IMDb can go up 100,000 points every week, up and down. But they don't know how to rate me. Before Amazon bought it, I was in the 5,000 range where the independent people knew how to take care of everybody, but not Amazon. But anyhow, I love doing this stuff. And when you work with the same crew over and over again, it's the same thing with the original actors. They got to be friends, most of them, and stayed friends through their, you know, dying breath. Shatner is still a pleasure to talk to when I get to see him at different conventions. And I've been able to work with Nichelle Nichols lately, and that's been a really big deal for me. We've worked at MegaCon down in Orlando. She's doing her last round of tours of conventions as she's getting ready to retire. And the 4th of July weekend, I'm going to be down at SuperCon in Miami with her at our booth again. At the convention, we're going to have George Takei there as well. So I'm looking forward to having both of them on our set.
Oh, that's really cool. And you bring some of the set pieces down there. Which set pieces get brought down?
We bring the captain's chair and the console that Sulu and Chekhov sat at and a base that they sit on. And we allow people to come in and just take their pictures for free. We put a backdrop up behind it. That's the panel. And we allow people to take their pictures for free. It's an advertisement for the Neutral Zone Studios. There are two complete sets of the Enterprise in the United States and some smaller pieces, smaller sets around the country, but two complete sets. Upstate New York has one. James Crawley has the license to do tours up there. And then we have one in Kingsland, Georgia, the Neutral Zone Studios, and we do nothing but film on it. So if you want to see sets, go see the one up in New York because it's a museum piece and it's beautiful and he's had all the major stars up there. And if you want to make a film, come down and see us at Neutral Zone Studios.
And there's also a Patreon, folks, for Neutral Zone, because the rent there is about $3,500 a month currently being paid by the owner, Ray Tessie, out of his retirement savings, and there's only so much of that to go around. So he's trying to get help from fans to pay those bills. Right now he's getting, I guess, about maybe two-thirds of it, which still means that about $11,000 a year is coming out of his own pocket. So elsewhere on this page, you will see a link to the Patreon. If you're not already a donor, you know, you just give $1 or $2 or $5 a month or more if you can afford it. Every little bit helps. The Neutral Zone sets are an amazing resource for fans. You know, fan filmmakers, as long as they're following the fan film guidelines, all they have to do is, you know, request a time. And if the time is available, they can come in and film there. It's $300 a day, which is ridiculously low if you think about the fact that you have pretty much every single set that they had back in Desilu in the 1960s, including a shuttlecraft if you need it, and most of engineering. So if you're not supporting this, please consider giving a little bit, because it's very unique and it's very important to fans. And that is the end of our plug for Neutral Zone Studios Patreon.
Well, thank you much for doing that. I just got my email today that my payment went out. So it does it automatically. You just sign up for it and you don't have to think about it, and set it up to what your budget can handle.
Yeah, probably cue you guys in that we're doing this this recording on July 1st, even if it doesn't actually get posted until next week.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's automatic, and I don't even have to worry about it. And I paid for my time there, but I'm still a member. So you do what you can to keep it going. It takes about 10,000 square feet of warehouse space to hold a complete set. There are other places in the country where you can go. You can go to, what's the one in Arkansas?
Warp 66 Studios.
Yeah, you can go there. They've got a really cool bridge, and they've started building some of the other pieces around it. But they're never going to be as good as the two complete sets that we have right now, unless they come up with a way to pay for it.
Well, you know, the challenge is always paying for it. I mean, you know, Starbase Studios, which, you know, existed in Oklahoma City first and then Arkansas, you know, it was living on free rent in Oklahoma City for, you know, 6 years. You know, so that meant that everything was just, you know, they could build out the sets, they could maintain the sets without having to spend money on anything other than electricity, which is why they simply charged people the cost of, you know, turning the lights on while you were filming there. Once they moved to Arkansas, it was much more problematic because there was rent to be paid. And Glenn Wolf and Dan Reynolds are the ones that are doing Warp 66 Studios, Wolf and Reynolds Productions, WARP, and 66 being the year that Star Trek was first premiered. But they are doing it on property that either Dan owns and or Glenn owns. So at least in that case, there's free rent, but obviously there's also, you know, limited space. So they don't, you know, space is always the final frontier. So they don't have 10,000 square feet. They can't build out engineering and auxiliary control, you know, and a full transporter room and a full sick bay and a bridge and a captain's quarters and a briefing room and corridors and Jeffrey's tubes and, you know, that's all stuff that Neutral Zone is offering. And obviously James Colley has it up in upstate New York, but it's not used for fan films anymore. It's used for tours, and it's obviously gorgeous. James has done an impeccable job recreating it. But, you know, if you're a fan film, if you want to film on these amazing sets, you pretty much have Neutral Zone Studios. And, you know, in the case of Warp 66, it's not necessarily open to anybody who wants to use it. It's sort of a Glenn and Dan have to kind of invite you to use it. You know, they're not making it completely exclusive only to their own Federation Files stuff. There's other folks that are going to be using. In fact, I'll be using it for interlude for a couple of scenes, you know, when I film later on this year. And the thing is that if you're a fan production, the easiest way for you to be able to use sets that are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars is to get yourself $300 a day and use Neutral Zone.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that if you got the idea that you want to do this, push forward with it. You don't need, for a fan film for a 15-minute or a 30-minute show, you don't need to rent it for 5 days. Get yourself organized. You can film, we've done it multiple times, film your entire series in a weekend.
Yes, I talk about that a little bit because, you know, when you go to Neutral Zone, and you know this probably as well as anybody, you have Royal Weaver and Sam Rooks, who are the ones who pretty much run it. They'll open it for you. They'll keep an eye on things. They'll handle your electricity and your lighting, and they'll make sure that you don't break the doors. But, you know, when you get there, what should you as a filmmaker have ready? You know, what homework do you have needed to do beforehand? I mean, obviously, you want your script and you know, want to make sure your actors show up. But, you know, what else is the difference between making your day, you know, getting it all filmed in 1 or 2 days, and not making your day?
You know, have your script polished and done before you start distributing it. Messing with actors by changing the scripts the day of filming can be a distraction and a time waster. Also, go through and block it out. Have a set list or a shot list. If you're going to be in the conference room at the beginning of your fan film and at the end of your fan film, don't film in sequence. Film both scenes at the same time. Redress if necessary. Put different people in if necessary. But it takes time to set up lighting. It takes time to get everything just right. And you don't want to do that more than once. Filming is not filmed in sequence. You don't start at the beginning of your script and start filming necessarily. If you're going to be on the bridge through multiple scenes, film all your scenes on the bridge. And just think about when you're putting this together, shoot all kinds of extra stuff while you're there because you're only going to be there for that little bit of time. Get people's reaction shots. Just, you know, when you're done with your lines, okay, look at the view screen, smile, look frightened, you know, do all that kind of stuff. Plan all that ahead, and you can get it in and out of there in a weekend for these limited shots that we're doing. It's very easy to do. You take time out for lunch, and you take some reasonable breaks, but not, you know, I'll see you back in 2 hours, 15-minute breaks maybe. We took a lot of them on mine because it was hot, and we had to go outside and cool off because it's a tin building, and when the sun's on it, it does tend to get hot. We've tried air conditioning in it, and it doesn't work, so that's one expense you're not going to have to worry about, but you're going to have to pick the time of year when it's best to do that. It's also, while I'm thinking about it, cold in the winter. I've had to say my lines first thing Saturday morning and have it be 17 degrees inside and out. And you put your jacket on to stay warm, but you take it off. You don't wear a jacket on the ship. So you got to plan everything that you're going to deal with while you're there and stay on that. Stay on a budget. If it's $300 a day for that, okay, you're going to have crafty. You got to feed your people during the day. You're going to have lunch, maybe dinner if you stay there that long. Typically what we would do is we would have lunch there, some crafty out, and at the end of the shoot, go to a local restaurant and eat and plan on that. There's plenty of cheap hotels and motels there, $50 to $70 a night should be a good range to look for. So you got to plan that in. You're going to have to plan transportation in. If you do have somebody who might be coming in from out of town, the Jacksonville Airport is about 30 minutes away. You're going to have to organize and have transportation for them. You can't send a principal to go get them if they're going to be on the set. So these are just things to think about, but plan it out and follow your plan.
That's very good advice. And by the way, I'd like to reiterate the idea of coverage, which means that when you film your scene and your camera is, you know, set up on the other side of the bridge and you're filming everybody, and then you go and you film, you know, the person sitting at communications, and then you film the person sitting in the command chair and whatever, and you just get one shot of each of them, it doesn't give your editor a lot of options, especially when you have to cut from one thing to another, or if there's, you know, a moment where the camera goes out of focus or a wink or something that doesn't work. You can always cut away to somebody's close-up, but at the same point in time, if you don't have a close-up and you don't have a cutaway, then you're stuck using that whole take. So, you know, when you're standing on the bridge, you know, get some really close-up shots of the captain in the captain's chair, some close-up shots of the person sitting in navigation, you know, just cover it all, just so you have, you might not ever use it, but at least you got it.
Yeah, if you watch mine, there's some rough cuts in there that I didn't like. But because it was so hot, we were getting our main shots in and then leaving as quickly as we could to get outside and cool off. It was almost 90 degrees inside when we were filming. And, of course, in some of the picture shots, you're going to see there's paper towels all over the place. We're constantly wiping our foreheads off. So I didn't get some of the shots that I needed to do some of that coverage. And I'm aware of it, and I knew about it, but trying to get all the shots in that you needed was the most critical part of it. And then if we had any time left over, I was going to try to go back and pick up some of those. But again, also thing to think of, there are fans in the warehouse that help cool it. But you can't run the fans while you're filming because the noise messes up your sound.
So it's not really a fan film. Okay. actually, I'll tell you a funny story. Speaking of paper towels, in my Ask video for Interlude, you can't really tell this, but I'm sweating profusely, at least on the scenes of me with my scruffy beard, because I interview myself, and I have this whole roll of paper towels next to me. And the reason for me sweating so much is not that I'm camera shy or anything, but I was sitting right under the air conditioning vent for my house, and so every time the air conditioning started blowing, it would come out on the microphone. And I had to turn off the air conditioning completely on what was a very hot day in Southern California. And so the house was going up to like 78, 79, 80 degrees. And, you know, there I am doing this, and I'm just spritzing. So, you know, you can't really see it, but, yeah, the paper towels are just, you know, constantly coming. You can sort of see it in my hair, and that if you want to watch that video. But, you know, you do what you can. Once again, these are fan films. In this case, a fan film without a fan, because I didn't even have a fan down there. But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when they're filming, professionals, when they're filming in a studio, that was built to be soundproof, that's good for climate control, and they run air conditioning when they're building it. But a lot of times you're working on location, and you got to deal with whatever they've got. I'm in a scene at the end of Black Panther, the scene where he's talking to the UN, and it was really in a government building, and they had an air conditioning switch that you would flip on and off, but it would take 10 minutes to cycle. So when the director would say, okay, we're ready to film, turn the air off, they'd have to wait 10 minutes before it would actually shut down and they could start filming. About halfway through the day, in the hottest part of the day, he finally said, forget it, turn it off and leave it off the rest of the day. It was very hot in there, needless to say, to have a room full of 100 or 200 people that we had in there for that particular shot.
And then, of course, you know, there's Walking Dead where, you know, they're filming in the hot Georgia sun, you know, day in and day out, and there's folks in, you know, zombie outfits and, you know, all the actors. I'm guessing, you know, that, you know, obviously you can't have air conditioning when you're filming outdoors. How do they keep you folks cool there?
Well, the big guys have trailers. The rest of us stand in the heat. And I did zombies early on, but I didn't want to do them anymore. Nowadays, the Walking Dead zombies are basically emaciated. There aren't enough smart people around because they can't find brains. I guess they're losing weight. And they wear complete body suits now. It's almost like wearing a wetsuit in 90-degree weather. Not something that's real comfortable. And I'm claustrophobic anyway, so I couldn't even wear those. When I did mine, we only really did the face. We had our full set of clothes on because they hadn't started falling off our body yet, and it was easy to do. But nowadays, these guys are real troopers, and I applaud them every time I see them.
All right. Let's change direction back to your fan film, because that's what we came to talk about, right?
I love talking about all fan films, so no problem with the diversion.
Well, the thing about your fan film, To Have Boldly Gone. Once again, folks, if you haven't watched it yet, watch it because we're going to talk about it. So it's very unique in terms of fan films because you, I don't know if you quite break the fourth wall, I suppose you do with that little commercial from Neutral Zone Studios, but you do have this sort of almost Zhang Zi, Zhang Zhu, whoever the Chinese fellow was. If you know the story of I dreamt I was a butterfly and I was flying hither and thither and then I woke up and I was wondering, was I a man who just dreamed he was a butterfly, or am I a butterfly now dreaming that I'm a man?
Yeah, that's an old story that is bringing back memories of reading it, but I can't remember all the details. But I didn't draw on that. Over my years of being a fan and watching it, I have my own set of dreams, and I try to incorporate a little bit of everything. I'm not as big of a geek as my character was. I've kind of made a caricature of all the geeks that I've known, and I like to call him my Shatner Get a Life geek, because he's really just everything is Star Trek. My Star Trek pancakes was a perfect example. And I, by the way, own all those props. I had to bring them out of different places. I had them and some of them in boxes. So I don't have those all over my place all the time. And I filmed it in my apartment because it was an easy thing to do. It was only me, so I could set up my camera and only had to worry about my cats. I had to take the collar off of one of my cats because it has a bell on it. Kept getting up and wanting to snuggle, and you could hear the bell on the camera. But other than that, I had no other problems. And when I shot it, I'm thinking, well, what would I do? And so I started dreaming about it. And that goes, okay, where's the dream begin and where's it end? And that's kind of what this is what's real and what's not, and does it make any difference? We all know about, you know, the cage and how their world there was really all a dream. And yet Captain Pike was able to go back to it and live out his life happily when he went back. The first time there, he didn't like it. It was a cage. But the second time, if you go willingly, is it a cage? We can live in our mind. There's been a few other episodes in Star Trek where they've the brains under the glass episode. I forget the names. I'm bad at trivia, but I remember the episodes.
Well, the brains under glass would be the Gamesters of Triskelion, or potentially Return to Tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, I know both of them the same, but the first one you mentioned.
Triskelion. I did three quadrilles on the newcomers.
Yes, that's a perfect example of, you know, you get too smart, you don't need your body anymore, you just live in your brain. And in essence, we can do that. We shouldn't do it too much because our body needs to be put to work every once in a while or it gets lazy. But we can live in our dreams. And this episode starts off with, is it real or is it a dream? We don't know. I want it left that way. And when it ends at the very end of part two, you hear the alarm going off at the very end.
I mean, structurally, it's an interesting episode. I mean, if you watch it, you sort of get a feeling of, okay, so what's going on? Is this a dream? Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? But structurally, it starts off where you are definitely in your mundane life. I mean, obviously, there's that little teaser thing, but you're in your mundane life, and it moves from the mundane life onto the Enterprise, but you are still you, the mundane. And then it evolves again to the point where you no longer have a memory of being the mundane. You are the captain. You've woken up from a dream of being a butterfly or whatever, or now maybe you are the butterfly, but you barely remember that because now you are the captain and you are existing in this reality without any hint of not belonging there. And then obviously at the very end, as you said, you know, there goes the alarm clock and, you know, which dream is ending when. And of course, you know, I don't think it needs to answer that question because I think that's what you probably were going for. Does it matter?
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of it is when we dream about it, if you're going to daydream, and I even had the daydream at the table of a dream within the dream, perhaps. Made that one completely absurd because he's a geek dreaming about being on the ship and having to play every role. Who hasn't dreamed about sitting at every place on that ship?
Yeah, I can't unsee that shot of you in the skirt, though.
We were laughing about that the entire time. You can't see very much of it, but they actually did put lipstick on me. So you can't put lipstick on a pig.
And yet you did.
Yeah, I've got the dress still. I may put it on again, but don't know when. We can't do a sequel to that following the guidelines, so I'll have to find out something else I can do.
Well, I mean, honestly, you probably could do a sequel because it's all over the place. You know, you could argue that the part where you're playing all the roles is not necessarily the full fan film. And to be very honest with you, I'm gonna break into a tangent here. I think for the most part, CBS doesn't care anymore. I know that's a very bold statement to say, and I think, you know, if there were another Axanar or another Renegades, you know, or a new Star Trek Continues started up with that level of quality, I think that CBS would be taking a much more active role in stepping in. But there are so many fan films right now that are doing series in one way or another. Obviously, you know, for the folks at Potemkin Pictures, they call each grouping the Tristan creative team or the Deimos creative team, but, you know, it's pretty much the same characters going through continuing storylines. It's a different story every episode, but that's sort of the idea of, you know, webisodes anyway. But I think that, you know, CBS takes a look at that and thinks, you know, these guys are basically making fan films with the change they find in their sofa. This is not anything we really need to worry about. And, you know, obviously there's a few times where the fan films have gone longer. Obviously Star Trek Continues didn't get bothered at all, but they were wrapping up. And then Sam Cockings, you know, he got contacted for Temporal Anomaly, but he wasn't contacted specifically for the length of it. It was more that they saw him using the footage from the Star Trek Next Generation movies, and like, that's a no-no. But once it was there, it's like, and you need to take out the music, and it can't be more than a half an hour. And ultimately Sam said, you know, look, I filmed this 4 years before the guidelines ever came out, and it's going to be very difficult for me to cut this down to anything less than, say, about 50 or 55 minutes. And CBS said, if you make the other changes, you can go over. And so he did.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that CBS's point of view initially, where they didn't have anything running. They were thinking about doing Discovery, but they hadn't come out with it yet. And then they were blown over by the quality of Prelude to Exynar, their promo video. And they knee-jerk reacted, and they've had to back it down a little bit from that.
It wasn't a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, this is not widely known, and technically I'm not supposed to know it, but, you know, this had been building for a while, and it wasn't just Exynar, it was Renegades. It was both of them together were giving CBS headaches. And that's why John Van Sitter talked about the space race. Exynar crossed the $1 million mark first. But Renegades had Tim Russ playing Tuvok and Walter Koenig playing Chekhov and, you know, Richard Hurd playing Admiral Paris. And, you know, there were all of these Star Trek actors reprising their roles in a post-Voyager reality. And in their mind, canon, they were even calling themselves a pilot. So, you know, CBS had headaches about all of this for months and months, and it wasn't going away. But what really tipped the scales, it wasn't that Alec was making his own studio. What really tipped the scales was the Vulcan scene. And Alec mentions this from, you know, discussions that he had with the folks at Paramount. The Vulcan scene was the first, even more so than Prelude, the Vulcan scene was the first time that CBS felt like something was good enough to be mistaken for real Star Trek. Not that it was real Star Trek, not that it was better than Star Trek, that's all BS. It wasn't. It was great, but it was two people walking, and it was very, you know, wooden Vulcan performances because they were, you know, Vulcans, and, you know, so this wasn't necessarily real Star Trek, but it was close enough to mistake it for it. And by this point, CBS knew that they were doing Discovery, and they knew that the season one plot of Discovery was a Klingon war that took place 10 years before Captain Kirk. And here was this feature-length film that this guy in Los Angeles was planning on doing that was going to be taking place during the Klingon War, quote-unquote, 20 years before Captain Kirk. Close enough. With a quality that if people saw it online, free on YouTube, might not realize that this wasn't the new show. And CBS knew that the new show was going to be on a subscription-based service. So the last thing you want is for people to think, oh, I don't have to pay to watch this, it's for free. And never think of it again. Like, oh, that was okay. You know, not great, not wonderful. Or really, it was great and was wonderful, but, you know, hey, I've seen it for free, I'm done. They didn't want that. So that had to be stopped, and it had to be stopped hard. But realistically, Renegades was also contacted. They were told, stop using the word pilot. You're not a pilot. If we want a pilot, we'll ask for one. We'll pay for one. It's not going to be a fan film. So it wasn't a knee-jerk reaction. A lot of stuff was happening at CBS months and months and months in advance of the decision.
Yeah, the knee-jerk reaction part of it, I think, had to do with the way they came out. For them to come out and say, stop making fan films initially, was a knee-jerk reaction. They backed that one down.
CBS never said, stop making fan films. I mean, obviously, there was a panic that went through the world of fan films when the lawsuit landed. But if you remember, after the lawsuit was announced, Tommy Kraft, who had come out with Star Trek Horizon in February, I believe it was, which was a month and a half after the lawsuit was filed, you know, he still came out with it. It was there. It was 90 minutes long. It was excellent. And then in April, he announced he was going to try to crowdfund $250,000 for Federation Rising, which would feature, by the way, the crew of the USS Discovery. That was his ship in the NX era. So that's when he was contacted by them saying, we'd like you to shut down this crowdfunding campaign, and we'd advise you not to make this fan film. They never gave him a cease and desist because there was nothing really to desist. He wasn't breaking any rules yet. He was just crowdfunding something. But they made it quite clear that this would be a bad idea if he continued, and so he stopped. Then there was a little bit of panic in the fan film world, but it wasn't more than 2 months before the guidelines came out. You know, as much as I hated the guidelines when they came out, I have to admit that they were in their own way a gift to fan films. God help me for saying that. But, I mean, I know some of the rules are draconian. I wish they would be different. But here was CBS saying, if you don't want to get sued, this is what you need to do. And, yeah, some of this might be hard to do, but most of it's not. You know, it's not that difficult to keep the word Star Trek out of your title and just make it, blah, 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 a Star Trek fan production. We're not telling you you can't crowdfund at all. We're giving you $50,000. If you can't make a Star Trek fan film decently, nobody's made a $50,000 fan film with the exception of Star Trek Continues since the guidelines came out, but the fan films are still decent.
Yeah, I mean, $50,000 is more than enough. You should be able to make your entire fan film for, you know, under $20,000, and that's going pretty good on what you're going to be paying for. A lot of it's going to be spent on special effects because you got to have all that. And that's probably the most expensive part of actually physically making a film nowadays.
And you raised what? You raised $4,000 into your $4,200 in your Indiegogo, right?
Yeah, it was 43 or something like that. And then I had a separate one on Facebook, so it was about 5,000.
So, and what did you use that money for?
It went for a number of things. I needed some new equipment. It went for transportation and some lodging for a couple of people. I did have to pay the $300 a day while we're down there. And my stay as a star in the thing, I couldn't get away with not having to pay for me because I had to be there. So I'm being sarcastic on that. But I had to pay for hotel rooms for pretty much 4 days worth, even though the production was only a couple of days. But I had to do other things while I was there. And pretty much all of May I was traveling, doing different things. I did a couple of other fan films during the month of May. I did a convention during the month of May, so I didn't work the entire month of May. I bought Crafty for everybody. When we all go out to dinner at the end of the shot, I'm eating part of it, but I'm paying for everybody. So, you know, you could say I am paying for my meal, but I'm paying for everybody's meal.
No, I think that's fair.
The daily food was all eaten there. I mean, we at the end of the day, we'd go out to dinner. One day, I actually had Domino's pizza delivered. Plug for them, but the guy was impressed. The guy was impressed by the set. We gave him a quick tour when he showed up.
Now there's a pizza guy, delivery guy, who's going to have a story to tell.
Yep. So, you don't want people wandering off during the day, and that was not a problem. But you've also got to have just a general food table, a crafty table that's got crackers and stuff like that. Water, you've got to have lots of water.
Yep.
Other things to drink if you want as well. Coffee in the morning, you've got to have coffee to keep everybody going, especially with my group because we're older and we need the coffee. So, but there were all expenses that were needed to do the shot. I mean, I didn't pay for anything personal out of any of this stuff. I had to buy some footage. Sam did a really good job with my little bit of video. I told him I just want stock footage, so don't go out and create anything. I've seen plenty of your work, so I know you've got some. And he was able to get it to me quickly and cheaply, and I'm very impressed with his work. It's amazing the amount of work. I got to see a little bit about what that looked like years ago. My older son got into some 3D graphic design work when he was in school early on. And he was showing me Maya and 3D Max and how he can make stuff. And I got in and play with it a little bit, but I'm not creative. But he would make some really cool stuff and planetary scenes and stuff, and it was really amazing. So I know what the capabilities are, but it's basically a full job in itself. You got to really focus on it. You got to learn the program. And me being a jack of all trades, didn't want to diversify myself anymore.
Nah, it's okay. You're allowed to, you know, let the people who know what they're doing do what they do best.
Yeah, I mean, on this one, to save money, I did everything as much as I could. It meant that I wrote this storyline, I directed it, I produced it, but I also edited it. Like I said, I wish I had a little bit more footage. I talked to the director for not giving me enough footage, but I did pretty much everything on this because I'm a jack of all trades, like I said, so I know how to work all this stuff, but it's not professional. But if it were professional, I probably couldn't show it.
Yeah, there you go.
And, you know, and we're all older Star Trek fans or sometimes a little grayed hair and sometimes overweight. And that's just kind of the way it goes.
We work with what we got.
Yeah, and unfortunately, my body doesn't work much anymore. I'm old enough that I've worn too many parts out. So I can't do the gym every week like I'd like to, like I used to. And it shows. And these uniforms are not very flattering to a body that's not perfect.
Yeah, the uniforms are not forgiving. I know. I've worn my fair share to conventions myself, and my profile is, shall we say, 8 to 9 months pregnant.
Well, I mean, even Shatner had problems, and they came out with a green top with the folds and the stuff to kind of help cover a little bit, and I think he even wore a girdle for a little while.
Yeah, oh yeah, in season 3, there's a whole bunch of places where you can clearly see the Kirk girdle through that very tight shirt. So, he wasn't fooling anybody, but, you know, hey, you know, he's still a great actor. Yes, he is a great actor. And you know how you know he's a great actor? Because it's 50 years later and we're still talking about him.
Yep, and he's still fun to talk to, but you got to know what his favorite topic is when you want to talk to him.
Horses.
Horses, that's it.
Yep.
You talk Star Trek and you get one-word answers. He's polite and will talk to you, but you mention horses and he'll take over the conversation.
Yeah, and if you really, really want to get him excited, say saddlebred. And if you really want to get him pissed off, talk about the fact that saddlebred horses are actually kind of not treated very humanely, but I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, but, I mean, he's got his horse, I guess, ranch out in south of Santa Barbara, and he's got a bigger place in Kentucky. He loves horses. And when I saw him doing the commercials, and I saw Kaylee Cuoco show up in his commercial as his daughter, I'm going, how could they possibly bring these two together? And then I realized they're both into horses.
Ah.
Because she's got her own horse, and he's got his horses, so they, I'm speculating, but they probably met someplace at a horse show or something, and, you know, in Hollywood, it's not what you know, but who you know.
Yeah, it all happens, and it happens. All right, so to wrap this up, what's coming next for Larry in the fan film world?
I can't tell you too much about it, but I am writing another story. It'll be a completely different story, probably more along the line of a traditional fan film instead of my oddball parody. It's going to still involve the set. I would like to do a couple of planetary scenes. And because of the insight of the and wisdom of the original designers of the starship, I don't have to worry about the expense of doing a landing because they have a transporter.
Yeah.
And that's why they invented it in the first place. So I will be using it to do a planetary part.
And are you going to use that same gang of actors that seem to be appearing in all the Neutral Zone Studio stuff?
I'm trying to. There's a lot of people involved that I really wanted to have on my other shots, too. But, again, everybody's seeing them. But, I mean, I like ensemble-type casts. There's a TV show, an old TV show, early 2000s, called Nero Wolf. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. It had Tim Hutton, the son of James Hutton, and one that hung out with John Wayne and did all those fancy movies back then. But Tim Hutton was one of the lead actors in it. And it was about this big fat detective who sent his Archie Goodwin out to do all the legwork, and then he'd just sit in his chair and come up with the answer. So it's kind of a cute storyline. But they used an ensemble cast. And every episode would come out, you'd see the same cast members in a different role. One guy may be a cop one time, and he may be a sous chef the next time. He may be, a detective or something else, and they'd have accents, and sometimes they wouldn't. And I just love watching that because you get to enjoy the same cast members but they're showing off all their talent as an ensemble cast. So I actually like that, and so I don't have any problem using all my friends again, and that's what we are. We're all friends anyway in this fan world.
Yeah, or we try to be.
Well, those of us that work together on a regular basis have to be. It'd be too hard to work with each other if we weren't.
Well, that's the message of fan films, folks. This is a community. You know, can't we all just get along? I hope so. It's my dream. So, anyway, Larry, I'd like to thank you for a very interesting and lively talk today.
Well, it was my pleasure again, like I said. Anytime you want to talk about Star Trek, just let me know. I can rattle on for a long time, enough to bore anybody.
I think it's true for all of us. All righty. Well, good luck with your future projects, and hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.